Blog Talk Radio.
They'll call it a mystery, but we're gonna call it
victory.
We'll be writing history. It's gonna be
victory.
There'll be signs on top of signs, just so you know that
history
is saying victory.
So sorry. Okay, this now
everybody should be on the line.
Okay.
All right.
Well, finally, thank you for your patience. So let me just introduce myself. This is Leslie. We're listening to the Gist of Freedom. This is an impromptu interview that we were honored to get at this last 10-15 minutes. I have on the line two descendants of families who are now owners for over 100 years of the land that their ancestors were once enslaved on. So I'm going to start with Mr. Jones. Could you please introduce yourself and tell
yes,
the audience about?
Yes, I'm Marvin T. Jones. I have an organization, ChawanDiscovery.org, Chawan Discovery Group. And my great-grandfather, Jack Robbins, who was a free person of color, served in the Civil War. He was in the 34th Infantry, U.S. Colored Troops, and USCT soldiers received, many of them received $300 bonuses or were supposed to get $300 bonuses, and he was able to take his bonus and he bought a farm in Hertford County, North Carolina. And my siblings and I are fourth generation owners of the farm. I was born on it. I've worked on it. I still work on it, although it's rented out. But there's still work to be done on it. I live in Washington, D.C. Concerning the Nat Turner Rebellion, Andrew Jackson Robbins' father, Noah, acquired a paper certifying that he was a free man of color 4 days after the rebellion. And this document was, the rebellion started on August 21st, 1831, and the document is dated August 25th, 1831. And it was a document he was supposed to have anyway by law. I think a lot of people ignored it if they wanted to, but during those days they really needed a document like that to prove that they were free, that they belonged where they belonged, that they were resident of the area. And that document has been passed down through six members of the family, and I now possess the document.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Miss Jess was telling me that there were several people, more than several, had come to her attention that can tell the same story that we're telling about our families still own the land that our slave, that was that our were our people, our relatives were enslaved on. Now, how
right.
we
I'm,
got
I'm,
the land.
Yes.
I just, we got ours in a complete different manner. My grandfather purchased for $300 the second farm. They sold him J.S. Musgrave, who was really his mother's white brother. J.S. Musgrave did not want anybody in Southampton County to know that he had black relatives or people in his family. So he offered to sell that piece of land to my grandfather for very cheap if he would not tell anyone there in Southampton County, let it be known that he was related to any black people in that county. He did not want people to know that his father, Dr. George Musgrave, had had children with my great-great-grandmother.
Mm.
My grandfather kept that promise to the Musgrave family, I guess, almost until he died, which he was in his late 80s when he died. He told my uncle, and my uncle kept the promise all those years, that we were not related to the Musgraves. J.S. Musgraves, that's how they identify our farm through taxes. They call it the J.S. Musgrave Tract. So that's the really story of how we got the land that our great-grandparents lived on, or slaved on.
Okay.
And I understand there are others out there who have another story.
Well, one thing that aided after the war was a lot of white people... landowners were broke. The war broke them, and they needed money. They needed the work of newly freed people. And your ancestor, you know, your African American ancestor, provided. It might have been a trade for land. It could have been a note, you know, whatever. And so a lot of whites had to sell their land, and there were black people who knew how to make good use of that situation. And your ancestor sounded like he was one of them.
Yes, he did. What I always tell, they didn't give him anything. My grandfather, my grandfather and my uncle. There were two uncles. They worked on Saturdays, on weekends, not on Sunday, never work on Sunday. But they worked on the weekends for other farmers to raise enough money to pay for that farm. The second farm he bought from him was larger than the first. It took them 3 years to pay the farm off because he felt like the war was coming. 1939, and there were rumblings about a world war coming, and that's how he paid for that farm. They worked themselves to pay for it in 3 years, and well, they didn't charge much for it anyway.
I thought
people, you know, you can see how they wanted land. They wanted to be have land. They never had a situation where they could own land, you know.
Well, you have a lot of control when that happens. When you're a landowner, it makes a big difference. It matters in an urban area if you're a homeowner. And so people banded together more on that. They were less distracted by all these other things, and they were focused on getting debts cleared and ownership. My grandparents... on the Jones side of my family, had the same issue. They took a note for a farm, and of course, if they missed the payment, they'd lose the whole farm. It was a contract, and they would lose the whole farm and get nothing back. And so, and my grandfather's mother was a co-signer of the bill, so it would have affected my great-grandmother as well. And so they farmed, my grandparents turned, they had two children, they that were born on the farm, and they turned the children over to my great-grandmother to raise while they farmed, and they did work like chop wood to sell to the railroad station, grew vegetables to sell to the steamboat 2 miles away on the Chowan River. They went to the cotton factory in our village and hauled cotton seed oil to be loaded at the train station. They did all kinds of things, and it was best to make the payment, the last payment, before it was due. Because even if you made the payment, that last payment, when it was due, a trick could be pulled on you. So you needed to be about 6 months. So you needed to be about 6 months ahead of due date, or 3 months ahead of due date, and that wouldn't give them any time to do anything about, you know, all they can do is turn the deed over to you.
Right.
I have a quick question for both of you, and either one could jump in as you wish. Do you guys still have the documentation, the deeds and so forth from your family's land?
Yes, we have them in the courthouse. And I think I have a copy of them here that my mother gave to me. And, see, we still, because we do stay, I have all the tax records, you know, that kind of thing, because we still own the land, and our family, some of them still live there. Our family, the grandchildren, I call them, I'm one of the grandchildren. My mother's dead and all of her sisters and brothers who owned it before we did. And we are living on the farm. Some of us, I have two houses on that farm that I rent out, I say one for myself to just visit. But all of us, the grandchildren, have was given an acre of land to build a house on. My grandfather always said that he wanted to see us living on that farm. And so that's our way of kind of keeping his wishes for that.
And do you make copies for all the grandchildren so they can see and feel and touch and smell these things?
Well, let me
tell
you, the grandchildren, we incorporated that land. It's an LLC, and with the shareholders being the grandchildren.
Gotcha.
And we did that to protect it because, understand, we had one grandchild, one of my cousins, to get in debt. Mm-hmm. And they tried to foreclose on our property.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when we decided to. We paid it off, that debt off that he owned, medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided at that point to, as an LLC, and no one can, the debt you make for yourself is your debt. It's not a part of anything else.
Got it.
Very good.
So that's why we had the LLC done. And that has protected us in many ways. We have had problems with the USDA programs down there in Cortland, not wanting to give us the same type of programs that some of the white farmers in the area had. I had to go to this, take it to a higher level than Cortland, and they fired the director down there. And now we got all programs that anybody else has.
Wonderful. And same question to you, Mr. Jones. Do you have the documentation, the original, and are you giving the copies to family members to cherish?
I don't believe we have original copies, but we have plenty of tax bills that we paid, and of course, the land is passed from my great grandfather to my grandfather to my mother to the rest of us, and the four of us. I usually scan documents like this, so I have digital copies. Let's see. We have a stronger political structure in Hertford County. It's a predominantly black county. The politicians are all African-American. almost all the elected officials are African American. And
where is this again?
Hereford County, which is about southeast of Southampton County,
mm-hmm.
in North Carolina.
Virginia. Oh, North Carolina. Okay, that's right.
It's
and
across the border.
About 10 miles, 15.
Yes, when you it's southeast of Southampton County, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Hereford County is, and so we have a stronger history of land ownership, and there's less likely of USDA foolishness. You know, we haven't had any, we haven't heard of any, but that's because we have larger numbers. And we have,
Now, Mr. Jones,
Hereford County has a completely different history. It's a strange history where you have mixed race people who have white mothers as well as white fathers.
Oh, okay.
Things are kind of turned upside down in Hereford County, or they were.
But now,
we would never hear of that in Southampton County. I mean, white mothers. There are plenty of white fathers.
No, you wouldn't in Southampton. It happened if you were closer to the Chesapeake Bay, and it happened 200 years ago. It started in the 1800s. That started disappearing.
Mm-hmm. Now,
but in the 1600s and 1700s, that was quite common.
Let's talk about how your families are preserving the land and maintaining it. I know I spoke to Ms. Hawkins in depth many, many times, and I'm amazed at her business skills. She's, like, extraordinary. I know very little. We talked a little bit, Mr. Jones, off record. But I know that you, too, have some creative ways to maintain the property and make it self-sufficient.
Well, there's a family of farmers who we grew up with, rode the school bus with, attended school with, who rent our farm. And they rent other land, and they own more land than we do. And they are very self-sufficient. The Chavis brothers, there were three of them. One of them unfortunately passed. And they love farming, and that's what they do. So they rent the land. We do get some payments for crops like soybean and corn. There's an arrangement there. It helps that my sister's a lawyer. And I'm there every month. Checking on the condition of barns and the house and plumbing and whatever. I've been, you know, reducing things that are growing in the ground that we don't want to take care of, like hedges, trimming trees, looking at timber. We do have the land. There are really several farms, several different parcels of farms, and I look at the timber, and we are trying to assess, you know, when it will be time to sell the timber. Of course, after you sell the timber, you have it replanted. The state pays for half the replanting. You pay the other half. And, you know, you keep a record and you talk to the county forester or the state forester about sale dates and whatever. The state makes its money off of, you know, gets its revenue off of the taxes of the timber sale. So that's why they encourage replanting. So, but that doesn't happen every year. It's the farming that happens every year.
Mm-hmm. And you have a similar story, correct?
Well, yes. We just sold our timber and to West Rock. And the timber usually takes about 20 to 25 years to grow. Under the old systems, and the state of Virginia does offer incentives and a USDA program for replanting, which we did one time before. This is the third time in my lifetime that this timber has been sold. And that is one source of revenue, but it's not the biggest. it is a really the biggest source of revenue for our farm. We rent our farm out. My uncles have passed, and my cousins are they're as old as I am, and which is old. They no longer farm, so we had to rent our farm out to white farmers. I want to tell you, you have to pick them because they don't want to pay you the rent
that
they will pay a white farmer. So you have a problem there. We found one that was kind of the odd person in the ball game here, and he offered us more than anybody did, which we took. And he farms and he does cotton. And we used to have peanuts. We used to grow big amounts of peanuts on our farm and cotton. But the peanut allotments, the federal government stopped giving allotments for growing peanuts. So we don't grow peanuts anymore at that rate. But that's what's going on down there. When I was a child, I mean, it was pea picking time, they call it. That's what the big crop was. Besides, and cotton was too. Now they have gone back to cotton in Southampton County. They make a lot of money on cotton. But our resources are really, the rent on the farm doesn't really pay the taxes and the upkeep, you know, things like that. But it's not a whole lot of money from the rent because most of our land is in timber. That's the largest crop we got there, and that's so often that you can sell your timber will grow that fast. So
I was going to ask you, being that the Black history is becoming more and more popular, people, especially you guys, are how close are you to the Smithsonian, the new African American Smithsonian Museum?
I live in D.C. I've been there twice. My wife went yesterday. A lot of it at the museum I'm familiar with because I talk about it. I do presentations, and I'm very familiar with a lot of what is in the museum. Plus, I'm a documentary photographer, and in my career over 40 years, I've photographed a lot of things associated with Black history. So, yeah.
And how far is your property from the museum itself?
It's 4 hours.
Whoa, I thought you were going to say
in other words,
that.
I live in D.C., and it takes me 4 hours on a good traffic day to get to Hertford County, passing through Southampton County every time.
And what about you, Ms. Hawkins? How far is your property?
Well, I live in Richmond at this time. And, you know, we're not that far from D.C., about an hour and a half, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another hour and a half to get to Southampton for us.
Okay, so from Southampton to the museum is how long?
It's about 3 hours.
Okay, same amount of time. But I was wondering, did the government designate any one of your properties as a historical site?
Well, we have a plaque from the county, really, for a century farm.
Mm-hmm.
We do have that. But we're trying to get this, Nat Turner place where he was captured on our farm. We're working with, I have some people who called me recently who works in D.C., and I can't even think of the name of the, what organization he works for up there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he has said he knows that he knows an architect, planner of parks,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to help us with that.
Okay.
And also, the largest help we are going to get is from the timber company who destroyed some of our property. Looked like it was destroyed to us, and we complained. We filed a notice with their company, who is a very big company, international. If you're going to deal with selling your timber, sell it to somebody who can back it up. I get that information from Mr. Jones. Anyway, they knew it was a historic site when they started. We made it clear to them, took them down there, and asked them not to cut the timber in that area because what we were going to do is have a park setting, and we wanted to be look as close to 1830 as we could, 1831
right.
as we could. And he left some trees there, but you know. But then again, he left a lot of debris.
Mm.
I mean, it was. And then we had made arrangements with him before he cut any timber to leave the path that goes to Nat Turner's cave. That's where he was found.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin who lived down there asked him about it, and he acted like he didn't say that he would do that. So I complained and wrote to his headquarters in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're offering us anything we want. They have offered trees, a park. They're going to make a road there, turnarounds, a parking lot, gates. They're offering us anything we want to start this Nat Turner Memorial Park.
I'm looking forward
wow.
to seeing this.
So that's what they're doing because
wow.
they don't want it out in these papers, national papers, that they destroyed a black historical site and a 100-year-old farm, black farm. They don't want that kind of notice.
Publicity. Right.
Yeah, they don't want it, yeah. So
yeah,
I think that's
kind of,
why they have agreed to
yeah.
do all of this.
Hmm.
What do you have to say, Mr. Jones? You have anything to add? Or
for many, that's not a concept they want to exist, 100-year-old black farms.
Right.
Right. And so we continue the effort.
Now, I got to ask you two questions, and they're not related, but I'm going to start with this one. How many people do you guys know that have the same type of story and own the property that their ancestors were enslaved on? Is you know, because I met about five of you within the last 3 to 4 months since the summer. And is this a common thing, you know, that is, are your neighbors under the same type of lineage? They share that same story, your African-American neighbors?
Well, again, my community was made of free people of color, so there were
okay.
some of our families were 100 years old when the Civil War started. So, I have, however, in Virginia, met a man that I'd have to look up, and his family not only bought land that his family was enslaved on, but he owns the cemetery of the enslavers.
Mm. Wow. Can you share his name? Because I would like to share that story.
I know who to call. Send me a reminder,
okay.
Leslie.
I'm sure will. And what about you, Ms. Hawkins?
And what was the question again? I was so busy listening to him.
Okay, the question is, the story is unique to me, being that I'm born second generation in the North, and, you know, I don't know much about the South. I only learned about people like yourselves, descendants of enslaved people who own the property that their ancestors were once enslaved on. I only learned about that recently. You're the first person, Ms. Hawkins.
Yeah,
is it common or is it uncommon? Do you know of any other people or families like yourself?
I might not know them, but in our area, when I was young, there were a lot of black farmers who owned their land.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they got it,
okay.
whatever, who their relatives were, but they owned a lot of land.
Okay.
The Tennessees, which is the only last name of Tennessee I have heard anywhere,
mm-hmm.
own big farms, you know, and some
mm-hmm.
of them still own the farms,
mm-hmm.
a part of it, but I just don't know their history, you know.
Okay, part two of the same question. Would you be interested in starting a national organization of family members who still own the land that their ancestors were once enslaved on? Would you start that organization?
I won't start.
I've already
it
started.
Go ahead.
Oh, please, Ms. Hawkins, you go first. Sorry.
I just wanted to say I would join an organization such as that, but I really would not have time to start one.
Okay, that's a fair enough answer. Go ahead, Mr. Jones.
I have the same answer. you know, you're living two lives. You're living away from the farm, you know, whether it's in Richmond or D.C., and you're managing what's going on in each location. Perhaps if there were enough people interested. One thing to start an organization, you have to have more interested people.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly have to have that. And so the benefits would be to talk about how to get more rent, how to get more revenue out of the farm, how to preserve it, the importance of it, how can you pass on the farm to descendants and make it a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it a benefit? Those are some of the benefits of such an organization. I can say that much.
And if you can purchase things in bulk as a unit, you know, as an organization, as opposed to as an individual, economically, that would help out a great deal. I know two other people right at the top of my head. One I interviewed, like I said earlier this week, her family property is in Florida. She has a historical marker on her. She just got it maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, I would like for that to happen to all the families that still own this property, because that story is lost. You know, we think that we were enslaved, we ran away, we got off the plantation, I became sharecroppers, and we never owned anything. But to have former enslaved people within one generation become landowners or homeowners is a story that's untold, and it's such an inspirational story. We need to share it and teach our children about these stories and to meet people like yourselves and to teach us how to do the same thing. You know, so that's why it's important to me. So I'm going to connect you, the two of you, with the other two people that I've met recently, and
all
hopefully something can happen. We may put all four of you on the line again and introduce yourselves and figure this out. But Sherry Sherrod comes to mind. What do you think of when you hear the name Sherry Sherrod?
I think of the lady who was a government person. I think it was Alabama or Georgia. Who I'm trying to think of the program that she was heading up and under what administration.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was either Bush. I think it was Bush.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. It may have been.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You're
I didn't think because it was long enough ago to be Bush, but I'm not sure who, you know, who was a kind of a advocate for black farmers and minority farmers.
Correct. All right, Mr. Jones, what do you think of when you hear Sherry Sherrod's name?
Well, Ms. Sherrod, I believe, was a farmer's daughter whose father put up strong resistance to Jim Crow, and she was a USDA official employee who was maligned by Breitbart News. And I've photographed her and met her at Howard University Law School. She was a speaker at Howard University Law School after she was maligned and it was shown that she was she was maligned by Breitbart News.
She was they took a clip, and this is before Trump started using the expression fake news. They created fake news.
Yes.
With one of her videos, they edited it so it would appear as though she was a racist, anti-white woman. And as a result, President Barack Obama was within his first 2 or 3 months of being a president, he told her and his people told her to pack her bags.
Right, it was Tom Vilsack.
Right. So her story is an awesome one because she has been advocating for black farmers all her life. She was part of SNCC, which was she was for voters' rights, voting rights, and all those things. So we have some great stories, as well as some. We have a lot of work to do. But go ahead.
Well, she did settle with Breitbart, and the terms were undisclosed.
Okay. And we're going to wrap this show up, but before we end the show, your name, the way I found you, Mr. Jones. Do you recall how I contacted you and why I contacted you?
It was through Facebook Messenger. I think you thought I was a descendant of Andrew Jackson, where my great grandfather is Andrew Jackson Robbins. I posted a piece on Facebook, Our Black Legacy, about on the Facebook page, group page, Our Black Legacy, about black farmers. And I posted I was a fourth generation farm owner, and that Andrew Jackson Robbins, my great grandfather, was the purchaser of the farm. And then that's how you heard about me through that post.
Okay, so let's just recap who you guys are. I don't know if you want anybody to contact you or anything of that nature. But if you have any closing words, do so. I can this show is marked private right now, and I won't mark it public until you give me your permission, and we'll take it from there. So you have any closing words, Ms. Hawkins?
Well, my closing advice to all young black people, if they do have land, to hold on to it. Our forefathers, our grandparents worked very hard to get that land. And I think some of us take it lightly that, they quickly to go to the cities and forget all about the farming. Farming is hard. It's not something easy to do. But I would advise anyone who has any land, any of our people who has any land anywhere, hold on to it. For your children. Thank you.
I have the same advice as Ms. Hawkins. In addition to holding on to land, learn what that means. It means you have to be fairly self-sufficient. You have to know that taxes have to be paid. You have to know that revenue has to be collected so you can pay the taxes. You have to have your timber evaluated. And one way of saving money, I saw a forest that was cut just last month. I drive past it again on the way in Hertford County. I pulled off the road on a later trip, and I measured the stumps, the width of the stumps, so I could know how large were the base of those trees, and so I can compare it to the base of the trees that we have, because we have been approached by people who want to cut the timber, but we know it's not ready. We're not ready to sell it. We know that if we wait 5 years, we could probably get 2 to 3 times as much money, and we can afford to wait 5 years. And so, in those last 5 years, a lot of volumes added. And so, learn little techniques on how to ask questions. Learn little techniques on how to make the land pay for itself.
Yes,
talk
because
to
ultimately
the landowners
it has to,
and talk to other landowners.
Right, it has to take care of itself.
And if you live in the city, you live in the city, buy land there too.
Right?
Yes.
And I want to say
buy
one
property.
Thing. I know in Virginia, the Forest Service there is excellent. They take you. All you have to do is pick up the phone to call them and ask them. what needs to be done. They told us that they need to be thinned, and then they gave us a share cost for thinning. They paid for thinning it. Then they would go down there and say, you need to do this, you need to do that. You know, and they're very helpful about that.
And don't let that scare you. That's only something to be done maybe once during the growing period of 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot of work. That part of forestry is not a lot of work, but it all requires some procedure.
Right. And when you're going to sell it, it took us 3 years to sell that land, trying to get, you know, we wanted cash. We didn't want with someone going in there cutting and paying you by the load. That's
right.
The worst way to sell timber. So, you know, find someone who has sold it before and who can tell you who the best people are to sell it to, and there are seasons within that time period to sell. You can't sell timber in the spring because the mills close down. It's good knowing a whole lot of that kind of stuff, the best time of year to sell it. Should you hire a consultant? Should you do this or try to sell it yourself? There are a lot of ways to sell timber, and it's helpful to, you know, to go through someone else who has already been through that.
And you could sell it through a bidding process. Let them bid for your timber.
Yes, that's another way to sell it.
We had a forestry agent. Not a government agent. Think of the person as a real estate agent, and he got 6%, just like a real estate agent would get 6%.
Right.
He evaluated the timber. In other words, what kind of trees are on the property? How big are they? What is the possible price? Is it time to sell? And.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this man is now retired and in a nursing home. We would love if he was still around because it worked out, but we'd love to use him again. But about 5 years, we'll have to go through. We will go through this, and he put it up for bid.
Mm-hmm. We had ours up for bid too. But I wanted to say one thing: be very careful with timber people. They are the most vicious people out there. I'm going to tell you, they are arguing with each other. I mean, they want to get the first bid on your property. That's what that is, you know, because it's a big business. And be very careful about who you select, even who wins the bid, because we had the thing that someone who bid it higher than anyone else, and come find out, we got a notice from our lawyer that they were the worst people to leave your property in terrible shape, in bad conditions. And, you know, some of them weren't true to what they say they were going to do, and they tried to get more time added on for their harvesting the timber. It's a lot of things. You got to just be careful, because just like any other business, people are cut out. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a good point. You want to restrict the harvesting period.
That's it.
You don't want,
that's what we had to do.
You don't want somebody to buy your timber and then for them to wait 5 years for it to get, 3 years for it to get even larger, you know,
right.
For the volume of timber to increase. To their benefit, and you are held up. Those are 3 years your forest could be regrowing. So they need to cut it, you know. They need to cut it in short order.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
They need to harvest it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They need to harvest it within a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have been talking to some entrepreneurs who have inherited air property, land that was once used to keep their ancestors in bondage, is now air property that they are maintaining in the spirit of entrepreneurship that was brought down to them from the enslaved ancestors. You can't get any better information anywhere else. If you don't own air property, like they suggested, you must go and start purchasing some property that you can leave for your children, be it in the city, out of the country, in different parts of the world, but purchase something that you own that you can pass on. And again, we're talking to Ms. Hawkins, who owns the land where Nat Turner surrendered himself when he had his revolt or his insurrection or uprising. And we're speaking to Mr. Jones, who has a letter in his family's vault, right, I could say?
Yes.
That voter letter. Go ahead. Explain this letter one more time before we close.
It's a county certificate certifying that my great-great-grandfather was a free man of color at the time of the Nat Turner Rebellion. He needed that as a pass to keep from being enslaved, killed, or whatever during the rebellion.
You know, Mr. Jones, you may be able to share that with that new museum.
Nope,
that
stays in North Carolina. It stays in North Carolina. The story, I can share the story with the museum, but the note stays in North Carolina.
Not the papers.
The paper stays in North Carolina.
You give them the copy. You give them a copy of the note.
Well, they'll have to hear about me. They'll have to hear about me first. I've already presented to the museum on what I had about 10 years ago, because they were in operation 10 years ago as they were formatting, as they were, you know, gathering things. So they know I exist, and they have plenty right now to deal with. they have plenty already to show.
Okay.
And I'm going back.
Hopefully we'll have a memorial park on your land, like we're going to see on Nat Turner's place with Ms. Hawkins' place. Hopefully both of you will have
I hope that you will see it. We're working on it now, but you know, those things take money, and they take, you know, even though the interest in the community among our neighboring farmers, they've torn down a lot of the houses that Nat Turner visited. So there's a lot of different things. Since the movie came out, they're interested again.
Oh, I do want to say one thing.
We don't know.
There's one thing I want to say about interest. When I do drive between Cortland and Borkins on Virginia Highway 35, I passed the Nat Turner marker.
Yeah.
And when I first saw that marker, I by that time knew that the rebellion had taken place around that area. I did not grow up knowing that it was just across the border from my county. And when I saw it up, I said, that marker should have been there years ago. It was 1991 or so. And then I realized, it's here because Doug Wilder is governor. And so the next time I saw Governor Wilder, the next time I saw him, I asked him about it. He said, oh, yeah, we put it there, but we had a lot of trouble. He said, even the black people didn't want that marker there.
Mm-hmm.
Even
That's
the black
right.
people
there's
were a, it, it was like they wanted to leave that thing alone.
There's one back, same marker, another one. It's back there in the back on Cabin Pond Road area. And there's also a road back there called Blackhead Road, which some of the white people in the area are complaining about the name of the road. They want to change the name. But the Board of Supervisors said, we can't change a name like that. You have to go further than this county to try to change the name of a street or road. But they're beginning
to change the name from what to what? Or what name
I don't know
they
what they
want
to change it to, but they want to change it from Blackhead Road. During that time of Nat Turner's rebellion, they had black heads on posts, on stickers, on posts posted up there on the longest road of the slaves they had killed.
Mm.
And now they want to get rid of the name, because it puts a bad light on the county.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to, I tell you, change the story.
Whitewash it.
County. That's what they're
yeah,
trying
whitewash
to do.
It.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only it's the only famous thing that happened in Southampton County.
Right.
The most famous person from Southampton County is Nat Turner.
Right, and I can tell you a story about that. They were trying to have I don't want to go into this gist. I know you got to sign off. But
no, I don't. Take your time.
Okay, they were trying to have a Nat rebellion or insurrection tour, they wanted to call it. And my cousins and I went to every meeting they had down there in Cortland about it. It was the meetings were given by the Southampton Historical Society. They were going to have this tour starting in Cortland and visiting these sites like Rebecca Vaughn's house and all Porter House, the houses that were involved in the rebellion. And we were going to be the last. At first, they didn't want to put us on the tour till I raised so much cane. And President would then with papers to prove that he was found on our property. So they put it in the paper then because I insisted on no less. You know, going to try to take our thunder away. And anyway, so they started with the white farmers didn't want the tour because they said people would be on their cropland and they had torn all the houses down, which I had visited. I knew what the houses looked like. They had been on that property years ago. But they tried to change it. Then I saw in the Historical Society paper, I believe in being a part of things to keep an eye on things. So I'm a member of the Southampton Historical Society, that Nat Turner was buried in Cortland. And I said, what? I didn't know he was buried in Cortland. I called the president of the society and asked her, why? Where was he buried and all of that? And she explained to me that he was a slave and they put him there with the rest of the slaves, open graves type of thing. And but his head had been cut off, and that's a whole other story I don't want to go into now. Because that would take too long to tell. I think Ms. Gist knows that the skull has been discovered and is near the Smithsonian being tested. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But I wanted to say that they're trying to change the history of it, you know, to make them seem better. And some of us are helping them. I have someone in my family who I was told by the Richmond Free Press this week that she went to a forum out in Williamsburg that this guy was speaking, one of my cousins. And he was speaking with one of the so-called victims of that rebellion, Pat family. And he had to say that, he didn't say it, but he was sat there and received it, that the man who was saying that his family were good people, good slave owners. You know, they didn't hurt anybody. The slaves were happy. I mean, in this day and time, to say that in an audience, she said half of the people walked out. But that's the kind of stuff that's still going around about slavery and about that road down there called Blackhead Road. And the sign, I went down there a couple of months ago. After you had been there. And did you see that sign that said Blackhead Road? I think you took a picture with it.
Yes. Ms. Shabazz, she did a short Facebook Live film on it and received thousands of views. Had your relatives.
Well, they're trying. It was in the Tidewater News, which is the paper of that area. They're trying to change the name. People are writing in the editor, they want to change the name of Blackhead Road. They don't want anybody to think how vicious slavery was.
And I'm going to I'll add a little to it. While I was researching, after I went to visit your site and saw, met you for the first time, I discovered that one of those people who had impelled one of the Nat Turner's brave, rebellious men, he had the nerve to execute, you know, one of the raiders, and then he wanted to file an insurance claim.
That's right, because slaves are worth something. They were worth their worth money.
Right, but the rules were you could not execute your
slave, quote, unless you gave them due process. Because he did not allow him to go to trial and go through the process of, you know, somehow proving that he was really involved, and that's why your letter is so important, Mr. Jones, he couldn't collect his insurance. The court case went up to the Supreme Court. I don't know if it went to the United States Supreme Court, but it went to a Supreme Court,
probably Virginia.
The district, federal district court.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
maybe.
And he didn't win. He didn't win. So there is a fascinating story behind that whole raid, that whole insurrection, that, like you said, they're trying to clean up and sanitize. But it was so entrenched, so institutionalized, so many different entities were involved with slavery, and all of them are hiding and saying they had nothing to do with it.
Right.
And and it was so involved. And it only speaks to how great your ancestors were to be able to overcome all those hurdles. And here you are today teaching other people how to preserve the air property. So I want to commend both of you for the work that you're doing within your own families, and then again to all the listeners and everyone that you've touched in your, you know, with your work. We all want to thank you.
Okay,
all right.
Well, you're very welcome. I wish I could
do
more.
Thank you. And we'll be in touch. I'll be in touch with you guys, and we'll have the other two or three people that are doing the same thing that you're doing, and hopefully we'll make a group. But again, thank you. Again, you can have parting words. I want you to have the last word, and then we'll say a final bye.
Well, I think I'll say it, not parting words.
Okay.
Well, always be diligent, be self-sufficient, focus on that, and I look forward to meeting both of you sometime.
Oh, thank you,
yes,
Mr. Jones.
That will happen. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I think we have
to
make that. Yes, we should all make arrangements to meet at the museum in D.C. I think that's a good idea, right?
I can do that.
We're going to invite Mr. Jones to stop at my house.
You can meet at my house. We can meet at my house. The museum's on 14th Street. I live on 14th Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when you're passing through Richmond sometimes, Mr. Jones, give me a call and just come on over.
All right.
And
I'll send a note through Ms. Guest to get your contact.
Okay. And I'll be glad to see you. Be glad to meet you.
All right.
Okay.
Same here.
I'm emailing the two of you as we speak. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.